Erlem Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello, and welcome again to Verulam Sport Podcasting. As always, the absolute supreme highlight of my working week, and tell you what, I know it's yours too. Verulam Sport Podcast. Each week, we have some fascinating debates. We have some big name chats. But this week, our debate, I think, is going to be one for the ages. We talk every week about sporting theatre. Well, sometimes in any theatre, you have your hero, but you need your villain. And sporting rivalries create great narrative. They create great conversation pieces, and they immortalize their two competitors or two teams. And we are doing just that. This week's Radio Verulam Podcast, we are shining a light, drilling into and debating what we deem the greatest rivalries in sporting history. As always, controversy will arise. As always, you will be awash with your own opinions. Who are your favourite sporting rivals? Who do you root for in these rivalries? That's even more compelling. Get involved. Want to hear from you. Want to keep you engaged. Tweet at Verulam Sport and keep involved. But as always, because it's your show every bit as much as it is ours, and you get that and you embrace it, the machine, Jason McKenna. As always, you've been kept busy this week on social media. What on earth have the listeners been saying in terms of their favourite all-time sporting rivalries? What's the top line?
It's a good one this week, Tony. And I think the rivalries kind of add to the narratives of sport, don't they? You know, we talked about unsung heroes the other week, Mount Rushmore as well. But these rivalries almost define seasons, don't they? You know, when A has to play against B for the final, then it makes it all that more tasty and amazing. And I have to mention that obviously this week we did have the North London Derby, and my team Arsenal did not come out on top. After a fantastic starting goal, we went 2-1 down.
Shane McKenna, God love you. I wasn't even going to bring that up, you know. I was going to let that one go under the radar. I'm slightly disappointing, I guess, from your red end of the North London rivalry and derby.
Yeah, the thing is, I wasn't too expecting too much. I think the kind of saying with Arsenal now at the moment is that we don't expect too much and we're still let down just a little bit, because you have players like David Luiz, Kolasinac, who, you know, try their best most of the time and still kind of make really basic errors. Jose Mourinho, he just loves to play against Arsenal. He's unbeaten at home against Arsenal in, I think, 14 league matches now. So I was going into this apprehensive anyway, because he knows how to play Arsenal and he knows how to get into our mind. So I was a little bit worried about that, and it came true. But, you know, give Spurs their due. It was a fantastic match. Both teams really put on a good show in this post-lockdown football where we've seen some turgid football. But as I was saying, on social media, Sean Murphy messaged in to say, come on, you Spurs, to me, because I think he probably knows that I'm an Arsenal fan. So thank you very much for that, Sean, talking about rivalries. Adrian also messaged in, and he said, only one great rivalry ever, and that has to be Celtic versus Rangers, which is a fantastic one. I don't know if you've mentioned it, Tony, but spoiler, I haven't mentioned the Old Firm derby up in Scotland. Michael has mentioned Federer and Nadal. Raphael has actually mentioned Vieira and Keane. And Andrew has mentioned Oakland Raiders and Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, that's something that I don't know much about there, Tony. So you're going to have to tell me about this social media message. What is the story there between those two clubs?
What it is, they are two of, going back to the 70s, the most successful outfits in NFL. And what they are is historically two kind of blue collar towns going at it. Oakland had always had this kind of misfit style. And John Madden famously took them to the Super Bowl, in which they beat the Steelers along the way. Before that, Chuck Knoll and the Steelers had had absolute dominance over the Raiders, just completely dominating, always kind of knocking the Raiders out in what is in football context, the semi-final stage of, for instance, the FA Cup. And just going on an absolute glorious run in the mid-70s. But they were united by this kind of blue-collar, working men's style of brass mouth, hard-nosed, just steely brand of football. They matched each other in that regard. And when they collided, quite simply, no love lost. And it was one of the most iconic moments in sport, where John Madden, who became a legendary broadcaster, whose name is still synonymous with the NFL through those who are into their computer gaming. You know, he is an absolute icon. And he was the coach who claimed, I think it was, the Oakland Raiders' first ever Super Bowl. And which along the way, they beat the Steelers. And for them and that club and that institution, it meant a real great deal. Two massive, massive clubs are going really back to, I mean, there have been bowls since for the Steelers, one in the 90s, one in the 2000s. They're up there amongst the most successful of all the franchises. But it's been a long time since there's been much bragging rights for the Oakland Raiders in that highly competitive, much, well, I'll say it the other way, not much love lost grudge match between those two. Great shout, that one.
Well, what I love there from the kind of social media is that I'm learning something and that people are also bringing up some fantastic topics there. And also, sorry to Adrian, like I said, I haven't mentioned Celtic Rangers, but Tony, who are you mentioning this week?
Right, I am going to kick things off. Do you know what? I wanted to go Ali Frazier. I really did. I ummed and ahed about it because I just love that. It's such a massively important three-way dance in which Ali claimed the two of three victories. But I thought to myself, goodness me, Tony, you spent about 20 minutes last week doing just that. So let's push things forwards. But no less explosive from a completely different world of sport. I'm going for Ovett versus Co. Lord Co, as it is now. This is voted moment 23 in the top 50 stunning Olympic moments from a Guardian Sports article back in 2012. Moment 23. In many ways, these guys were the perfect opponents. One in Covet from a poorer background, the other Co, more privileged. One relatively short, Co, the other tall and rangy. One from the north, the other the south. Diametrically opposed, these two supreme athletes, though, formed two sides of a singular coin, united by a rare athletic talent and fearsome competitive spirit. Their divergency was embodied, and I think you'll like this, Jason. You know, just listen tight to this one. In their completely unique approaches to training, Co was guided by his father, Peter. He'd run the hills of Sheffield, fairly standard, but, and this is quite revolutionary in the 70s, very much par for the course here in our 2020 world, but back in the 70s, guided by Peter Co, Seb would embrace blood chemical analysis, physiological testing, all kinds of different biomechanic trials to find the one that is most optimum for his own personal body size, weight, ratio. Again, in 2020, all that kind of technological embracement, almost man meets machine-esque thinking, it's par for the course, isn't it? We've come to embrace it and accept it. Back in those days, 70s through to the 80s,
very, very revolutionary there. And I guess very forward thinking for Seb to be at the forefront of that, which is now our norm. By contrast, Steve Ovette and his coach Henry Wilson led him on countless runs across the sand dunes of Methymewell near Bridgend. I always picture kind of the scene in Rocky when I think of Ovette running those sand dunes. But there we go. Ovette took up the rule book, though, and in a completely different way to Coe, ripped it asunder. He would take a completely scattergun approach to his running program. In just 10 days, a matter of weeks before the Olympics in 1980, Moscow Olympics, again, they were voted 23rd most stunning Olympic moment, this great battle. In 10 days, weeks before, Ovette would run a mile in Oslo, 800 metres in Gothenburg, a 600 metres in Crystal Palace, and then 3,000 metres in Welwyn Garden City in Hertfordshire. I mean, they're divergent, different styles, completely got nothing really whatsoever to do with all of these running in the Olympics. The textbook is you focus in and then you build up too. Again, totally different rule-breaking approaches to training there. Coe observed in reference to this peculiar, I think it is fair to say, approach to the build-up that Ovette embraced. I remember, Coe observed, coaches reaching for their tranquilizers when they heard that this was his build-up. They were unusual rivals as well, in that they were rarely in the same track at the same time. Indeed, Coe actually had built into her contract a non-Ovette competition clause. Obviously, that goes out the window when it comes to Olympic time. Just to give it some kind of context, in a kind of contemporary world, 800-meter rivals Kenya's Radisha and Kaki from the Sudan faced each other six times within three seasons. Coe and Ovette would only do so six times across a 15-plus-year career. But it was the battle for the record books, which would cause the collision in Moscow to be so anticipated. Coe, in the space of 41 days back in 1979, smashed world records in 800 metres, the mile, and 1500 metres within 41 days, just over a month. He became the first person all time to hold records concurrently in those events. In 1980, the Olympic year, he would add the 1,000 metre record to his haul. Ovette, though, stepped up to the plate. He beat Coe's time over the mile and latterly would equal Coe's record in the 1500 metres, which many people will recall the image. Almost, we've talked about Usain Bolt's slightly premature celebratory style. Maybe Ovette was Bolt Mark One. He celebrated waving to the crowd in jubilation as he was approaching the home straight. Surely, if he'd just put his head down and finished the job, he would also have beaten Coe's record there. Dave Moorcraft, because of this anticipation, described the Moscow Games as the Coe-Ovette Olympics. Coe was the favourite for the 800 metres, but the usually self-assured star was apprehensive, sleeping poorly before the final. And he even uncharacteristically dropped a jar of milk at breakfast the morning of the 800-meter final. By contrast, Ovette was relaxed, laughing and joking with all the other competitors, shaking their hands, appearing the picture of confidence and serenity. Coe ran an appalling race. He was actually ranked last, going to the final 300 meters of his favourite 800. And though he had his absolute characteristic sprint finish, seeing him race through the field, he couldn't overhaul Ovette, who grabbed the gold. Coe described it as the very worst 800 metres race of his career. His father and trainer, Peter, was even more severe. You raced like, and I will refuse to use the exact word, suffice it to say, it's an important part of the female anatomy. The two would collide again a few days later in the final of the 1500 meters. This time, Ovett was the favorite. He'd not been beaten over this distance, 1500 meters, in 45 races spanning 3 years before this final. But Co was supreme, taking gold and ensuring a dead heat, one all between these two white hot rivals. Now, years later, these fierce foes are firm friends. But for serving up some sporting drama and bringing greatness out of each other, they've got to be up there, for me, for the greatest rivals in sport. Jason, your thoughts on this diverse relationship and highly competitive rivalry?
What I really like there is, one of the points I want to pick out is actually the fact that, which one was it had the no, was it the no Ovett clause? Was it Co?
It was Co, yes. Co had literally written into contracts. They did face, as I say, six times in their career, but usually they would be in different events at the same meet. And basically, there was one event, I can't recall precisely what it was, at the height of kind of Co's record-breaking run, where Ovett, they were on the same track, and Ovett found out that Co was actually earning nine times as much for doing the exact same event, and was incredibly furious. And subsequently, Co, as I say, built that clause into his contract. So they literally, although they would be oftentimes at the same meet, it would be over different distances. But again, all of that, call it politics, call it economics, whatever you may choose to break it down as, goes out of the window for that granddaddy of them all, the Olympics. And as I say, that one, 1980 Olympics in Moscow, when they shared one all at the 800 and the 1500 meters, all-time classic.
Yeah, for me then, I feel a little bit disappointed that fans were almost cheated of more meetings between the two. The fact that there was only six meetings, it would be kind of like saying, I don't know, Messi versus Ronaldo, you know, they had a no kind of playing each other clause. And I think a lot of fans would tune out of events because of that. One thing that I actually want to put to you, and it's kind of a discussion in the kind of athletics community, but on the same kind of discussion of people not turning up to events, obviously you've described a really kind of tense, amazing moment there, but we do have to remember that the 1980 Olympics was also boycotted by some of the best in the world. Do you think that if the best of the best could have been there, Co and Ovett were obviously up there with the best of the best, but if
it's a really, really valid point. But again, let's not forget that Co held records again at 1.4 concurrently. And again, this emblem of their relationship was that what they were almost hunting down was the records that they would set. They were kind of raising the bar. In the previous, I think it was the European Championships, again, when they were pitted together, was actually won by a German athlete, but almost nobody had heard of him. I don't think he went on, I can't recall his name, I don't think he really ever threatened the record books or anything like that. It was just an odd event. So I think it's a really, really wonderful point, but in context, Moorcroft himself, a great runner and a great commentator, described it as the Ovett Co Olympics. They were one and two. And as I say, in the 1500 meters where Ovett was favorite, he hadn't been beaten by anybody in 45 races. Granted, again, there is that aspect whereby they were never on that race. But that was not Co's main event. Co very much was the 800 meter champ. Very good across a mile. And as I say, he did hold those four world records. And again, to give credit to Co, again, let's not forget that the first athlete all time to hold gold world records concurrently at 800, 1500 meters and the mile. And then he added a fourth. So it's just fascinating. In a way, the fact that they weren't necessarily on the same track together really added the kind of cachet and the prestige of this games, maybe making it even more magical.
Yeah, I think it definitely added to the Olympic experience, because that was kind of, as you said, one of the only places that they would meet. So I think that does add to the wonderful narrative of the 1980 Olympics. And you kind of carefully explained it as well, that they were the best of the best. So the fact that a lot of American athletes, or those around the world, you know, I'm sure there are other countries that could have put those to compete, it kind of breaks down that narrative that some do put out there to almost devalue Ko and Covet unfairly, you know. So I can't really argue with that. So I really like that choice of the two rivals there, Tony.
It's a fascinating one, and as always, I know you have got your opinions. Continue to tweet us at Verum Sport. Love to hear from you. Favorite sporting rivals, and more critically, maybe, where do you stand? Who is your favorite in these rivalry moments? Who do you root for? Get involved. Tweet at Verum Sport. Remember, always, it's your show, every single bit as much as it is ours. But on this show tonight, it's now over to the machine, Jason McKenna, to introduce his first pick in his own favorite sporting rivalries.
Well, Jason, I tell you what, but before I get on to mine, Tony, you know, you've said it there. Who is your favourite out of the two of those athletes that you've just discussed?
It's a really good question. I just love the fact that they were so different. It's not really even a fair comparison. It's kind of like chalk and cheese, as I said at the start of that. Just so divergent in literally every single sense, but united almost like two sides of the coin, the yin and the yang, the black and the white side of the Tao image. I have so much admiration for what Ko has now gone on to be, Lord Sebastian Ko, to give him his full title. And again, he is the head of the IAAF, the president. Just worlds apart. I guess for me, I was always I kind of love a maverick, and I just love the way that Ovetz, again, would do this crazy run into a games with just different events that had bore no real relevancy to what he was going to try to achieve at the Olympics. He was always that sort of, the more of the maverick of the two, although I love the maverick qualities of Ko himself embracing the sporting technologies and kind of paving the way in that regard. If I had to choose, I think I'd go Ovet. I liked his more sort of chip on the shoulder style, kind of working class attitude, but they're two greats. And, you know, if I was in a slightly different mood, you ask me the question tomorrow, I may even go for the more classical, more pure running form of the innovative Ko. But tonight, since you put me on the spot, I've sold myself on it. I'm going over it.
Well, I definitely have an answer to my two in a second, but I'm going to talk through Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal. Now, I think these two have impacted tennis over the last decade more than any other two, and it's a real narrative. I really love it. And starting with the facts, you know, I'm the machine McKenna. I love my facts. And they played each other 40 times, with Nadal leading the head-to-head 24-16. Also, and I think this is probably one of the most important things, Nadal leads Federer 14-10 in finals. So he's got that winning spirit as well over Federer. But what amazes me most is that these guys have, you know, come up against each other 40 times, but not once have they played in the US Open. So that's a record there that's still to be made in terms of who wins that one. But in the mid-2000s, as I mentioned, these two produced some of the finest tennis we've ever seen. And they actually met in French and Wimbledon Open finals for three consecutive years. And it kind of culminated in what many believe to be the greatest tennis match in history, Wimbledon 2008. I don't know if you remember that one, Tony. It was a real, like, kind of classic, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's one of those that really always springs to my mind when it comes to these great rivals. I mean, because Federer was the king on grass. Obviously, Nadal's hegemony, Roland Garros, is almost unique in all of sports. We'll build on to that. But I think that was Nadal overcoming Federer for the first time at the Wimbledon arena. And just almost, whilst it is still the case that Fed is winningest at the present with 20, Nadal on 19 hunting him down. These guys are just era-defining. And what I love about this, Jason, is that it's always going to be remembered as a great era of men's tennis. Of course, Djokovic just behind and Andy Murray has chipped in. But the bottom line is these two warriors, Federer and Nadal, have really elevated the game. And I'm so delighted we're talking tennis because when we did our Mount Rushmore sport last week, as challenging as it was, either all, indeed, any of the above here could have made the face in that Mount Rushmore. We couldn't quite find a place for them, but I'm delighted you brought them to the table tonight. So, yeah, really loving this.
Well, I will tell everybody in a second who I would have picked for that Mount Rushmore because I definitely have a favourite. But what I love about these two as well, kind of playing into the narrative here, Tony, and also, you know, with your selection of Coe and Ovette, these two have very, very different styles of play. Federer is the technical one, maybe the artisan, definitely the technician on the court. You know, he's so tactical and he makes play look effortless. But also, in many ways, he's pragmatic. He's efficient. Mm-hmm. He's energy saving with his flow across the court. And overall, he's not very aggressive. He's not particularly power serving. He doesn't come up for smashes too often. He doesn't do too much or too little of everything. And he's always willing to adapt to opponents' weaknesses, strengths. He's just absolutely amazing. But what I admire most, I think, when I watch him, is his vision. You know, you can always see that he's calculating, figuring out the move, what to do best. But also, you get this feeling that he's always mindful that there's going to be another game. There's going to be another set. He's always saving energy for the upcoming next kind of battle on the court. So, you know, some may criticize it that he doesn't give it his all every set. But I think for me, it's really mindful and almost genius that he's thinking, no, this is tennis can be, you know, 1, 2, 3, even 4 hours long as a match. You've got to be able to almost be a marathon runner as well as a sprinter going across the court. Now, talking of sprinters, Nadal is the complete opposite of Federer. His game is born out of pure aggression, physicality. He's like a four on the court. He's amazing. He's muscular, but he is quick too. Now, his aggressive physical style of play, he's super quick, he's super strong, but it sometimes has cost Nadal in terms of games, but also in health as well. Tactically, sometimes he's too predictable. You know what he's going to do each time. He's the baseline playing style that is, you know, top spin, ground strokes. But if you come to the net, like, you know, Federer does against him, and also Djokovic, kind of have him figured out a little bit sometimes, but also in terms of his actual physical health, playing so aggressively has really cost Nadal at times. And one has to question whether he might have won more if he'd, you know, taken a back foot sometimes, adapted his play style. But this is Nadal. He's heavy top spin, Mr. Ground Stroke, beautiful, quickest across court, and it explains why he's got his clay dominance as well. But as we said, Federer, total 20 major titles, Nadal with 19, first and second in the all-time males list of most major titles. And arguably, it would have been amazing to see if Federer had been by himself or Nadal had been by himself. But the other argument is that these rivals kept each other going. We see a lot of sports stars end or kind of lose heart once they've made it to the top, but maybe the fact that they were neck and neck for so long pushed them further. What do you think on that, Tony?
I just think they really do bring the best out of each other because similarly, as you said, to the different styles of Ovette and Coe, they are worlds apart in style, form, but innovative, both of them. And I genuinely agree that competitive edge that unites all great sporting rivalries is really kind of one of the things that these two great competitors buy into. I've got a few things because I just love this topic. I'm so glad we've brought it up today because, again, I really was flirting with Federer making my Mount Rushmore of sports. Quick one on Nadal first. Genetically a freak, and of course, I tease there may well be some Barcelona references a bit later on tonight. But of course, his uncle was a great Barcelona footballer. So that kind of gene pool has been very, I think, privileged his way. But again, what a great product of such supreme dedication and application that applies to all great sports stars. Quick one on Federer. I'd like your take on this. Because he is the winningest. He was a prodigy. I think he beat the great Sampras very early in his career at Wimbledon. He was a Wimbledon junior champion. But I found this a compelling aspect of the Federer story. He only really truly fulfilled that recognized talent and potential when he kind of got with his now wife and mother of his children. I'm not saying he was a wild child before that, but I just think that there is a very direct correlation between him going from this kind of prodigious talent but unfulfilled to what he is, and the stats don't lie, as it stands until Nadal and or Djokovic surpass, Fed is king, number one, as you say, with a 20. So I just find that fascinating. So just, Jason, your take on the genetic supremacy. And then, as they say, maybe it is true, Federer might prove that behind every great man is an even greater woman.
Well, I really like that. And I didn't actually know that in terms of the statistics. And if it backs up, it backs up. Because I think, you know, Graham would probably be a better person to kind of enlighten this kind of psychology. I think there's probably a big psychological element there. Maybe it's a safety thing with Federer. He just felt more within himself, trusted, loved. There's probably quite a few positive feelings there. On the kind of Federer situation as well with his family, I would say that maybe now that he's become, you know, the most winning male individual player, maybe he's trying to produce the best doubles team because he keeps producing twins, doesn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So maybe that's his secret plan now, to dominate the world of tennis, but on the doubles court. But, you know, with Federer, with Nadal, they're just absolute machines. They're amazing on the court. And I just love the narratives that they both bring up. And for me, you know, I've teased it throughout, and my favourite, without doubt, has to be Federer. You know, Nadal has the data. Nadal is the one that's won this battle, but Federer is the most winning player of all time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that he's lost more to Nadal doesn't matter to me because I love the way the entertainment of Federer, he makes it just look so effortless. It's beauty, it's art every time that you watch him. However, with Nadal, you know, I don't insult him. He is absolutely amazing as well, but I feel he's too one-dimensional, whereas with Federer, he can do anything.
Absolutely. I mean, goodness me, some of the innovative shots that Federer comes with, almost badminton-esque in the flick of a wrist occasionally. I just think he is up there with the greatest sports stars all time. My final quick point, because I would also veer on the side of Federer here in this great rivalry. Again, just an aesthetic point. And then also the fact that he is still number one when it comes down to the overall number of slams. But one thing that I would like to just, I guess, ask about Nadal is, in my living memory, I can't recall a single sports person having such dominance at a single event as Nadal's record at Paris, at Roland Garros. We've spoken in the past, of course, about Senna at Monaco. You know, maybe it's in contention. But other than that, I honestly can't think of an individual sports star showing such sheer total control and dominance over one individual event. Just quickly, your thoughts on that.
Well, do you know the actual win percentage slash win to loss record at Roland Garros. Do you know the numbers on that, Tony?
Do you know, I did. Off the top of my head, I can't remember them, but I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. It was, you know, I think he must have won at least five in a row. And so it's staggering. Have you got the data?
Yeah, so Rafael Nadal has the unbelievable 99% winning percentage at the French Open, putting him squarely in the lead amongst all men in all Grand Slams, you know, the most dominant of any sort of event. He's got a 66-1 record. I mean, that is obscene, isn't it? That is just absolutely ridiculous. And in terms of it, you know, we're talking there about Ovette kind of not concentrating on certain events, you know, making themselves good at everything. And Federer is good at everything. But then you do have to really respect somebody that just hones their craft on one area. You know, Lionel Messi is the best at passing scoring. You know, Rafael Nadal is the best on a clay court. That is something that will probably stay with him forever. And when you think of clay, when you think of that dusty orange surface, Nadal will be there for years to come. And I think that is something that, you know, even if he isn't the winningest, he will be the winningest on the clay court. So I think that's an amazing, amazing record to have.
Truly, truly astonishing. And, you know, again, kind of encapsulates what was the case, which is I can't bring to mind anybody else on an individual event who can even come close to that type of record. Before we move on, I'm going to make one final quick point on this rivalry because I think it's been brilliantly dissected. And as I say, I'm so chuffed we're covering a bit of tennis tonight. But I actually feel sorry for Djokovic. I think Djokovic is most likely of these guys to actually be, when this era is all said and done, sitting atop the winningest, as I like to say, record. He's on 17. He's much younger. Again, his health not necessarily as strong as it was, but there were signs last season that coming back to that. And he, whereas Federer and Nadal, they are kind of divisive, they're always at least fan favourites. It's almost like the crowd just adores both for completely different reasons. Whereas Djokovic, by contrast, I've found to be almost the pantomime villain, and almost despite his 17, and I'm sure he's got a real chance of surpassing both when it's all said and done. So despite the facts, it seems to me that he's never won the crowd and hasn't ever kind of got the same limelight, perhaps, as the two greats we've analysed tonight. Just ever so quickly, Jason, before we move it on, your thoughts on Djokovic and his role in what has been this great era of men's tennis?
Well, it's kind of an amazing kind of, in statistical sense, I think we visited it before, but the 1980s still dominates the 2010s and 2020s. You know, all the biggest male tennis stars, biggest footballers, I don't know about rugby, but they're all born in the 1980s, you know, and people kind of love that era. But in terms of Djokovic, he might be kind of a victim of what we talked about before with the unsung heroes. Maybe it's his personality, or that the fact that he's not always on social media, you know, doing this, doing that. It's kind of a media game. And Djokovic probably just doesn't want to play with the media. He probably doesn't want to give them the time. He probably might be focusing on family, friends, or just pure commitment to his sport, which I think a lot of these unsung, undervalued people in history are kind of falling victim of, because they just want to concentrate on their craft. He probably doesn't play in the most appealing way in terms of Federer is the artisan, Nadal is the aggressive, whereas Djokovic does the best of both. You know, again, he's a pragmatic player, but maybe not as beautiful as Federer. So I do agree with you, and I really rate Djokovic as well. And I also agree with you that I think he probably will, at the age of 33, he's still got time to be the most, you know, the player with the most individual singles title male player of all time.
brilliantly broken down. I'm sure you've got your opinions. I'd love to hear your views on Djokovic because, you know, he's never won the crown. There's got to be reasons for that. Tweet us at Verum Sport your thoughts on Djokovic, the unsung hero of this great era of men's tennis. And then I'd love your views on this one. I think Jason's broken it down brilliantly. It is a great rivalry. It's up there with the best of all time, Nadal Federer. Federer is the man with 20, Nadal on 19, but Nadal's record, as we've said at Roland Garros, is supreme, and he holds bragging rights when they collide, who is the numero uno for you in that great rivalry. Get involved. Tweet us at Verum Sports. Remember always, this is your show, every single bit, as much as it is ours. But moving it on, maybe to compensate for the fact last week I was a little, I just loved our chat with Mount Rushmore last week. I truly, truly did. I'm sure you listening enjoyed it too. But I was a little disappointed we couldn't get any tennis featured. Maybe subconsciously this night I've had that in my mind and I'm setting the record straight. I'm serving up another ace sporting rivalry from the world of tennis, going back an era or two. Going back to a different world indeed. I'm talking the Iceman Borg versus Mr. Emotional. You cannot be serious, John McEnroe. Well, these guys were deadly serious when they collided. Didn't meet in terms of statistics numerically quite as much in terms of quantity as the legendary Federer and Nadal battles you've explained. But just check this out. 14 times, I mean, it was 22, including, you know, an official tournament or whatever. 14 times in Grand Slams slash official tournament play. The record, dead heat, 7-7. But in terms of slams, it was John McEnroe, Mr. Emotional, Mr. I Cannot Be Serious, who was the dominant force, winning 3-1 at the slam level. But like so many of this brilliant conversation in terms of rivalries, they were so connected by being so different, both stylistically and physically and everything in between. Borg was the Iceman. And of course, McEnroe, so emotional. Again, you talk to people in terms of their psychology, and most of us great sports stars do have that ability to take that emotional energy and control it. Often, McEnroe simply could not control his emotions. But that, again, was why he was so renowned and, in a weird way, so incredibly loved across the world. You mentioned, of course, that great final between those two greats, Federer and Nadal, 2008. Well, there were many tennis purists who say that the 1980 men's final at Wimbledon is the finest tennis final all time. Borg was seeking his fifth straight title at SW19. McEnroe, in many ways, that day was the pantomime villain, booed vociferously, but he grew, he earned the crowd's respect. In a legendary fourth set tiebreak, McEnroe would save 5 match points and would ultimately prevail 18-16. However, Borg would go on to claim the title that day. Borg was the winner, but McEnroe gained immense respect. It was also the last time that the great Swede would prevail over McEnroe at that Grand Slam level. Remember, 7-all across all 14 recognized official meets. But in terms of slams, the American holds the edge 3-1. Indeed, McEnroe would overcome Borg in the 1980 US Grand Slam. Interestingly, weirdly, you mentioned that Fed and Nadal never competed at a final at the US Open. Well, these two greats did it twice, both of which times, the first in 1980. Then again, in 1981, it would be John McEnroe holding aloft the title. But culmination of this great rivalry really might have occurred at the 1981 Wimbledon final, a repeat of that classic from the year before. It would see McEnroe claim his first Wimbledon title, and it ended an amazing run of 41 straight victories at Wimbledon for Borg. McEnroe, as I say, would then go on to beat Borg in the 81 US final, which would cause Borg to retire shortly afterwards. Very young, 27. We talk about these modern era greats still going straight on into their 30s. In many ways, you could argue that McEnroe had broken the spirit of Borg, who had been so accustomed to dominating. I think Borg overall won more slams in his career, ranking at present sixth all time with 11. McEnroe claimed 7, but of those 7, 3 were in competition against Borg. As I say, Borg walked away after the 81 US final. McEnroe would forge another great rivalry with another great American, Connors. But that's another story for another day. For today, this great clash of styles, clash of cultures, 7-all in all 14 competitive matches, were real icons of their era, era definers, and up there with the greats in terms of sporting rivalries. Jason, your thoughts?
Yeah, what I really love is the fact that this is a rivalry where they're equal on games, but in terms of, you know, the one that matters, the final, McEnroe comes out on top. And also, again, kind of thinking of the fans, thinking of the narrative, thinking of sadness here that actually Borg, you know, retired so early at 26. The pressure got to him, and, you know, I hope that he doesn't kind of ever regret that. And he put his health and mental health first, which is really admirable in terms of that. But in terms of the story there, McEnroe, you have to say the fact that he beat him in 3 finals to 1. He's got to be on top there. It probably plays on Borg's mind. And McEnroe has to be the one that probably goes, haha, I beat you. You know, even though it's 7-all, the finals are the big ones, aren't they, Tony? You know, if I'm a person, you know, I might have beaten somebody 100 times, but if they beat me in that all-important Wimbledon final, I won't ever forget that. That's what matters. When you get to the end of your career, it's trophies. So, unfortunately, I have to say that McEnroe won that one. But in terms of the actual players here, again, I'm choosing players, and in a second, I'm sure you'll give your favourite. But I would actually say that Borg is my favourite. You know, again, probably with my personality, machine-like, he was so amazing, so dedicated to the sport. And in a weird way, I like the fact that he retired early. You know, he stayed at the top. He did have a failed comeback, which, again, is almost Ali-esque. I wish that he just left it, that he was forever young, forever people wanted more. So in a way, I would say that it spoils his legacy a little bit, but not too much. So Borg is always my favourite of the two. And in many ways, I didn't like the antics of McEnroe as well. I like what I call dark arts in sports, and if you master them, they're very good. But I think McEnroe pushed it a little bit too much and was just almost like an annoying child.
He did have that petulancy, there's no question about it. But he also had that fierce competitive spirit. And again, that fourth set tiebreak at Wimbledon, which McEnroe won 18-16, would go on to lose that final. But maybe in a way, that was the day where the petulant boy became a true champion man and really stepped up and then would subsequently win those 3 straight finals. But I got to say, in terms of aesthetics, I would always hear Veer on the side of Borg. Borg was a real trailblazer in every sense. And I'm going to say this much. As much as we've eulogized about Federer, I think you could argue that Borg was the prototype for Federer. Again, the innovation in shot style, the kind of cool grace in which he carried himself across the court, deceptively quick without ever appearing to overexert. Great serve, a great serve volleyo, hence why he won 5 straight Wimbledons. That was something that maybe even he had an edge over Federer in. But I'm just talking in terms of the package. For me, he was almost the prototype to which Federer took the baton and, of course, raised it. So for that reason, I'm not saying there would be no Federer without a Borg, but I'm saying in terms of a model, it was certainly a model that I think he studied very closely and then went on, as all greats do, to breathe his own style into and surpass. But as I say, for those reasons, for me, as a style icon, as a trailblazer, and indeed still sixth all time on the Grand Slam winning list, despite that early retirement, it is the Iceman who cometh for me.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that somebody who exited the game so early is still up there, a bit like Senna himself, but obviously Senna departed in much more dramatic and sad circumstances, but a testament to both of them that ending so early in their careers, but still maintaining that top positions. But I'm going to move on to my selections here, and the final one for us. But I think I'm going to go out here and actually maybe say that this is the biggest rivalry in world sport. It's definitely in football. I will put my hands up. You know, as much as I love the North London Derby, it pales in comparison to what goes on in El Clasico. Yes, it's Real Madrid versus Barcelona. It is probably one of the most watched, most talked about sporting moments in the calendar year. You know, people talk about it. It happens at least twice a year, but they often meet in finals, semi-finals, Champions Leagues. So it is more often than just two league games. Now, the football is always entertainment, but I do have to put the beautiful game aside for just a moment, because there are serious historical things here. It's more than just about football. It's about politics, identity, and there are many unsavoury incidents that blight the relationship between these two clubs, and emotion does spill on and off the pitch. But I want to kind of avoid controversy. I don't want to cause upset here because, you know, we're Verulam Sport here. We want to keep things light and happy. So I want to talk about these two having opposing ideologies on the pitch, and also a really funny, fascinating, controversial transfer that still mars the Madrid-Barca story to this day. But some quick stats, as I'm sure many have missed the stat attack. The first game was played 13th of May 1902. Barcelona won 3-1 in the Copa de la Coronación. Most appearance in El Clásicos goes to currently playing Sergio Ramos with 44. And the most goals in this tie, well, I'll let you guess this one, Tony. Who do you think is Mr. El Clásico?
I mean, so many great names have graced these great teams. Before this unbelievable modern era, I think the great Hungarian Puskás from the 50s was so, so prolific. But when it comes to it nowadays, it's got to be between. We were debating it last week, and he made your Mount Rushmore. Ronaldo, who is Real Madrid's all-time top scorer, and of course Messi, who's graced it so well. I thought Ronaldo, the original Ronaldo, was awesome in his Barcelona era, incidentally. But I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to just take an educated guess, and I'm going to say that man, Lionel Messi.
Yes, you're dead right there. Mr. Messi is Mr. El Clasico. 26 goals. Absolutely astonishing. But talking of, you know, Borg McEnroe, most amazingly to me, 244 matches, and they are drawn with 96 wins each. Absolutely astonishing. Now, like you said, there's obviously other kind of uncompetitive, non, you know, official games that have happened. But in terms of official matches, 96 wins apiece. It just kind of adds to that narrative that they're neck and neck, and they do play such different styles as well. Now, talking of that, throughout their histories, Real Madrid have been the Hollywood club, the blockbuster club, with names, buying talent, and even buying big managers as well. You know, they're not ones to kind of be shunned by big price tags. El Galacticos was penned because of Madrid's penchant for buying the world's best talent. The side have bought many of the best players on the planet, but not always to a successful story here. They buy the biggest, they buy the best, but I think one of the problems here is a lack of kind of youth development at the club, and also a lack of kind of concentrating on an overarching ideology, which we say so many times with Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Obviously, post Cruyff, it really defined what Barcelona was going to be. But with Madrid, there's never really been a defining kind of thing. They bring in managers, they bring in players, but there's no kind of set thing. And it's always a joke as well that Madrid kind of go through managers faster than they could go through hot meals. You know, it's absolutely crazy, the turnover there. The one that's kind of stayed recently is Zidane. And I think it's kind of emblematic of what goes on at Real Madrid. One of the most expensive players of all time, Gareth Bale, is now sitting on the bench because a previous manager brought in Bale, absolutely loved him, was playing him, and to be fair to him, he scored probably the best ever Champions League goal final, and now he can't get into the team because Zidane, he doesn't fit in with his playing style. This is a problem that Madrid have had, and I think it will carry on as well, because Madrid are not going to be patient with people. Unless, you know, something changes in the world of football. But Barcelona, on the other hand, are the development club. You know, La Masia was a symbol. And I say was because, sadly, in recent years, they've kind of lost that will to produce talent from within the club. Again, politics, but we're talking football politics here, of the Catalan club has meant that some of the dedication to Cruyffian ideology has been abandoned in pursuit of what I would call Barcelona's Galacticos project. You know, it kind of started with Ibrahimovic, but they spent big on Neymar, who, to be fair, did fit in, but then they spent big on other players that just haven't worked. Coutinho is probably the biggest and best example of that. They brought him in, they thought, you know, we won't bring somebody in who's played through the La Masia, the Barca identity. No, we're just going to keep buying. And I think that's really sad. But Barcelona have produced a lot of talent in comparison to Madrid. None more so than the elite class of 2008. You know, we talk of the class of 92 with Madrid. We've got to talk about the class of 2008 with Barcelona, who arguably were just as good, if not better. You know, that's one that we can really kind of etch out. But the 2008 class obviously started with Guardiola, moulded a little bit by Villanova, and then maybe moulded a little bit more by Enrique, and some of the best football the planet has ever seen. So, you know, these are two teams that are not just ideology different in terms of their fan base, but also the way that they play on the pitch. And you got to say as well, Real Madrid do love a kind of cheeky dark arts play style, with Ramos really embodying that, with, I think, record red cards in El Clasico, Champions League. He is a man that doesn't mind a fight. But one of the most controversial moments here, we talk about Figo, but I think the original, do you know who I'm talking about here when I mention Di Stefano? You know, he was the man that was supposed to be at Barcelona, but he went to Madrid and said, do you know much about this kind of story here, Tony?
Not really. I mean, I'm aware of the name Di Stefano, who is, you know, one of those that a name to conjure with. But fill us in, explain a bit more.
So Di Stefano, now, obviously, in the present, is Mr. Madrid. You know, he went on to win 6 European titles with them. But at the time, he was actually destined to go to Barcelona. But it's something that has really kind of carried on for the decades, something that you thought would have been sorted out by now, but still people really don't know the truth of what went on. And a lot of journalists have really tried to kind of pen what actually happened, none more so than Sid Lowe. He does a fantastic kind of exploration with his amazing book, Fear and Loathing in La Liga. I would recommend people to read that. It's really good. But Di Stefano was actually playing in Colombia, because the Argentinian league was on strike. And so his contract to Millonarios was actually already up in the air. And then FIFA agreed with Colombia and Argentina that they would kind of allow the Colombian league to be real. Before that, they actually played with a pirate flag, which I think is really cool. the Pirate League, you know. But it's a really fascinating story. Now, because he was playing in an unofficial league, Di Stefano didn't have an official contract. So when Barcelona went to swoop for him after a fantastic world tour in the 1952s, he couldn't actually properly sign for them. He had to wait a year and a half. Now, in this time, this allowed Real Madrid to kind of slip in. If you want to kind of use a modern term, they slipped into the DMs of Alfredo Di Stefano and kind of, you know, turned his head. They said, we'll give you more money. And they offered Milaneros actually a larger fee as well. Now, Barcelona at the time were going through quite a successful period in their history. They won three La Ligas between 47 and 52. And that obviously didn't please the then president of Barcelona, somebody that, you know, we'll all know the name of, Santiago Bernabéu, the person who the stadium is named after. And he set his sights on building, you know, probably Galacticos 1.0. He was going to buy the world's best talent because he didn't like that these Barcelona, the Catalans, were winning over them. Now, the Spanish FA president at the time had to kind of get involved because Real Madrid had bought Di Stefano in 1953. Barcelona had bought him in 1952, but who owned the player? Well, nobody could agree. Milaneros were kind of flirting with both teams because they wanted the money. Now, to add controversy, the Franco government tried to shun and stop all discussions by banning the purchase of foreign players, which both clubs, you know, one thing that they could actually agree on, they said, no, that's really bad. We want to buy the best players in the world. So they reduced that. Barcelona then tried to sell Di Stefano to Juventus. Real Madrid appealed. They maintained their story of ownership. It was absolutely crazy back and forth. So the foreigners ban was overturned, and then the FA stepped in for a compromise, which is absolutely baffling now. They said that Madrid and Barcelona would share, year by year, the ownership of Di Stefano. One year he would play for one year he'd play for the other. Absolutely crazy. In the end, this never happened. Madrid got their way. Barcelona were forced to sell their shares of Di Stefano. Mm-hmm. Now, some say, obviously with the context, again, we won't go too much into the politics, but some say the force was due to underhand and maybe forceful threats, which were kind of given to Barcelona, to their board, to their president, to all the people involved, and even Di Stefano himself was actually apparently threatened. But as I mentioned a little bit earlier, Sidlow writes about this, and he says that a lot of these kind of claims of threats and underhand action cannot be verified. Kubala, a few years earlier, was a fantastic footballer, and Barcelona snatched him from Madrid. So these claims from Barcelona that Di Stefano was underhand kind of taken by Barcelona, by Madrid, aided by the government, seem a little bit unfounded, but I wouldn't say that it didn't happen because we just don't know. Whatever went on in Franco's regime, he was a Madrid fan. We do have to say that. But I think the fact that decades on from 1950, that this is still in folklore as one of the most amazing moments in footballing history, I think it just shows you how crazy and how deep running this kind of discussion between Barca, Real Madrid is. I think it's so defining of one of the best footballing stories in the world. I don't know, do you have a favourite out of the two, Tony? What more can you add to this amazing, amazing story of Real versus Barca?
No, I really love that narrative. It's, again, something I'm kind of aware of the player, but not the legend. And it almost plays out like some kind of Hollywood-esque movie. Love that. And I think always these things get amplified and exaggerated. But I think oftentimes it's very much the case that that old one about the smoke requires fire syndrome. So just fascinating. And I'm sure that's compelling to many listening. Get your views in on it. Tweet at Verum Sport. Love to hear from you. I love, Jason, as well, that you broke that down. And it's 96-96. That is such a strong sample of football, isn't it, to be deadlocked after all this time against so many great names from both sides. And there is this, I think, sometimes when it comes to these type of rivalries, a real desire to oversimplify, to make one the goodie and the other the baddie. And I think it's never as clear cut as that. You yourself have explained, some of the pre-Cruyff era shenanigans at Barcelona and their need to have X meter height. And then subsequently, we chatted when we were talking about great sporting movies and More Than a Manager, Bobby Robson thought was treated shockingly at Barcelona, when of course there is that desire in your own narrative to sort of almost consider Real the team who are the management merry-go-round of the two. I think they are always literally more nuanced than all that. But what they are is worlds apart from a cultural stance. The Catalan versus literally the Royal. Real is Royal. And that regal backing of the capital. They're united in the sense that one thing that I find interesting, I'm only going to just touch upon it, is that we might sometimes bemoan the way Premier League money is filtered down. But Sky's Uber money goes... Everybody gets a piece of that pie. The way that the teams Barcelona and Real negotiate their own deals in much the same way that it may be becoming possible in the Wild West with Amazon and this and that is so far superior to the rest of the La Liga that it's borderline offensive, that nobody is on a level playing field. So what's Atletico Madrid are doing at the moment to almost just cling on and compete is astonishing. My final point, though, I just adore the tiki-taka style that has been Barcelona's way and maybe came to the fore with your man Cruyff. But whilst they are deadlocked at 96-96, at the moment, we often times have to expand the horizons when we are so closely aligned, when there are such heated competition. And the now 11, I think, Champions Leagues that Real have in their cabinet at the Bernabeu far surpasses Barcelona's efforts at that elite of the elite at the European game. And whether one cares to diminish them through their Galactico approach or raise a glass, you can't simply come away from it is a game to win. And those trophies, those Champions Leagues that have been done over the years, again, the Puskas and Di Stefano era, into then, of course, Zidane himself and Bale. Again, McManaman himself getting a great goal in a final. For me, maybe that is the acid test. And it certainly is something that in this great rivalry, Real have the bragging rights.
Yeah, for me, I love facets about both of them. You know, I love the kind of commitment to youth, or as I said, previous commitment to youth with Barcelona. But then I don't like the way that the club has become so political. You know, it's all about money now with them. And it's always been about money with Madrid, to be fair. But at least they were always honest about that. I would say, though, out of the two, I'm actually more of a Madrid fan. I love the club, as you said there, in terms of the most, decorated in terms of European football. And I think that is the highest achievement in football. They're also, you know, the biggest in La Liga with 33 titles. In terms of Champions League, it's actually 13. So that's
13.
It's absolutely amazing. And I don't think anybody else comes even close to it. You know, the likes of AC Milan, Liverpool, I think are about half or less than half that as the second most winning teams of all time in terms of that. You know, I love bits about Madrid. I love the Cruyff element as well. But just, you know, Madrid has always been my team. And then when Ronaldo went there and he broke all the records, yes, they're pragmatists. Yes, you know, that they are the masters of the dark arts. But, you know, you don't pick who you fall in love with. No, I fell in love with all those kind of Champions League nights, those moments where they just dominated on the pitch and you're like, wow. So, yeah, for me, I'm a Madrid man. Would you say that you choose between the two there, Tony? Were you saying that you pick Madrid, or is it a grey area for you?
I am going Madrid purely because, again, when they are so tight and there's so many fascinating component pieces, you know, I expand the horizons. And that 13, as you say, Champions League, which stands alone, gives them superiority and makes them, I think, the most important European club in the continent. And again, one of the most recognizable brands across planet Earth. There are so many different aspects to it, but that alone, for me, makes them stand over and apart from Barcelona in this phenomenal rivalry. As you said, maybe the most competitive, most compelling, most politically nuanced of all sporting rivalries. And it has been a wonderful conversation. As always it is, Jason, I raise a glass to you. As always, I invite you to get involved. Tweet us at Verum Sport. I know you've got your opinions on favourite sporting rivalries. Who have we missed out? Again, I'd love to have profiled Ali Fraser, but thought we did that justice last week. Got opinions on that one? Drop us a tweet at Verum Sport. Where do you stand on Real versus Barcelona? Love to hear from you. Tweet us at Verum Sport. Keep them coming. And I tell you what, a bit later on today, we're going to issue out a challenge to you to give us our next 3 weeks' debates, because always, it's your show. Every bit as much as it is ours. So thank you, as always, for listening. Keep well, keep safe, keep tuned to Verum Sport. All the best.